We can choose. We can actively choose how we feel or experience something. This is a choice. It may not feel like that perhaps at the moment, but the more you believe that that is possible, that you can actually do that.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about their failures and what they learn from them. I'm your host, Ozan Varol. Today's guest on the show is Frans Johansson. An entrepreneur, creative thinker, and acclaimed international speaker, Frans has lived all his life at the intersection. He has started a healthcare business, a software company, a hedge fund, as well as an innovation firm. Frans is the author of The Medici Effect and The Click Moments. He is also the founder and CEO of The Medici Group. You can learn all about their work at themedicigroup.com. That's themedicigroup.com. In the episode, Frans and I talk about how Frans's early life experiences influenced the work that he's doing today, how he accidentally ended up attending Harvard Business School. This is a really great story. The 10-second vision that shaped Frans's ideas on diversity and innovation. Why diversity in the workplace doesn't work without inclusion. And those two terms, as Frans explains in the interview, refer to very different concepts, even though they tend to be conflated. How to help diverse teams become more innovative. Why Frans thinks that failure and success go hand in hand. How people can take away positive lessons from failure. And finally, what Frans learned from his failed tech startup. Before I play you the interview, my new book, Think Like a Rocket Scientist, forthcoming in April 2020, is now available for pre-order. I've been ecstatic about the early reviews of the book. The book was named a must-read by Susan Cain, Endlessly Fascinating by Daniel Pink, and Bursting with Practical Insights by Adam Grant. Now, if you pre-order the book, I know it won't come out until April, but if you pre-order it today, you'll get digital access to the book to read on your favorite device within 7 days of your pre-order. That means you can start reading the book months before it is released to the public. You'll also get pre-order bonuses worth at least 10 times the cost of the book. You can check out all those bonuses at rocketsciencebook.com. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Frans Johansson. And thank you, as always, for listening. Frans, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to our chat.
Likewise, as I mentioned to you before we started recording here, I loved reading The Medici Effect, and I'm really excited to delve deeper into some of the principles that you talk about in the book. But I first want to begin with your background, because you've got such an interesting background. You grew up in Sweden at the intersection of your father's Swedish culture and your mother's Southern African American and Cherokee cultures. How did that upbringing, that those early life experiences, inform the work that you do today?
Yes, that was indeed how I grew up. And it has been hugely influential in how I think about, you know, my own identity, what I do, and particularly the work that I do today. What could essentially summarize how I see my mission, if you will, in the world. It's this idea that diversity drives innovation. By bringing together difference, we have a better shot at changing the world and changing it for the better. And that was basically how I grew up. I grew up in a world of difference. We had it was different races, different countries, different cultures. And I could see from my parents that whenever they were able to make connections and then build on those connections and sort of create new ideas because of that, what drove all that was that difference. So it's just been something that became very intuitive to me as I sort of traveled through life. I kept on seeing these principles play out over and over again along multiple sort of dimensions of diversity. So it's just been huge.
Sure. And speaking of traveling across life, you also traveled and left Sweden for the United States. What prompted that move?
You know, it was college and the desire to explore the American sort of a side of who I am. But my mother had a she was a teacher. She had this idea that in Sweden, education was kind of generally better for up until about high school compared to the United States. In high school, they were more or less equivalent. But when it came to colleges, there was no comparison. Go and seek out some schools in the U.S. and see what you can do there. And so that was actually that was a helpful piece of advice. I don't think that was the main reason why I actually did it, but it got me off my butt to actually apply. And it would turn out to be absolutely 100% correct. When I came to the States, I was able to explore yet another intersection. Here was me bringing portions of what it meant to be Swedish and bringing them to the States and looking for new opportunities to connect differences.
It's interesting. So I grew up in Istanbul, Turkey, and came to the United States for college as well. And the exact same perception exists in Turkey as well with respect to the quality of the high school education. The widespread idea in Turkey, which I think is largely true, is that the high school education in Turkey is a lot more rigorous than the United States. But then college is the exact opposite. The quality of a college education in the United States far exceeds that of what you would find in Turkey, which is also one of the reasons why I immigrated to the United States when I was 17.
Well, so there we go. I mean, that was one of the prompts. I don't know if I knew at the time that that meant that hence the rest of my life were going to be there, but that is actually what ended up happening. Me here, I have to say.
And how did you wind up at deciding to go to business school? I believe you attended Harvard, right?
If you'd asked me a couple of years before I ended up at HBS, Harvard Business School, I would have said with great conviction and clarity that there is no way I will go to business school. My path was very clear. I was going to do a PhD in marine biology and undergrad at Brown University, which is where I went to college. At Brown University, where I went to college, I studied environmental science. After actually having started in physics, I do believe that your background is in astrophysics, right?
Yep, that's right. Yep.
That was where I was going down. That was the path I was going down until I felt like the math was just overwhelming a bit to me towards the later stages there. So anyway, environmental science was where I was honing in when I was in college, and that was what I was going to do as a PhD. And what happened was that when I applied to the PhD program that I really wanted to go to, and it was only really one, it was one professor in particular I wanted to work with, one of my recommenders forgot to send in the recommendation. And I didn't find out until it was way too late that my application was incomplete. So I was kind of put on this wait list. That action made me realize that actually, wow, I don't actually think I want to do this PhD in marine biology. It opened the aperture. So all of a sudden, I was open to other things. And business school all of a sudden seemed to make more sense. I had started a company out of undergrad, a healthcare company, together with my cousin. We started actually several companies together. And it had been successful. But I'd always seen it as sort of something I wanted to do before I went into a PhD program. As that became successful, I realized this might be it. This entrepreneurial journey I went on might be it. And now I need to learn a bit more about business and ended up at HBS.
I want to talk a little bit more about the Medici effect, and maybe we can transition to that. And specifically about how you came up with the idea and the phrase. I mean, you mentioned earlier that some of your early life experiences informed this idea that diversity drives innovation. But at what point in your career did you actually decide to write a book around these concepts and also found the company around these concepts?
That's absolutely right. My life experience has told me this. I'd seen it growing up. I'd seen it in college, where environmental science is a very interdisciplinary science. So I could see the same principles play out across different disciplines. And then I started a company in Baltimore right after undergrad, and I went to business school. I started another company, which is a software company, during sort of the whole .com era. I actually left business school without completing the degree at the time. And it was with that software company sort of started trailing downwards, and we ultimately shut it down. It was in that time frame where I literally woke up one morning and I had this vision in my inner mind's eye, if you will. It was of two light beams intersecting. And I realized if these light beams represent fields or disciplines or cultures, And if it's true that new ideas are combinations of existing ideas, which was something that I explored as a thought experiment, then where these fields or industries or cultures intersect, where they touch, the number of idea combinations actually don't add, they multiply. And it's sort of this image and a mathematical formula, and it all took just 10 seconds, but it's just stuck with me. And I started exploring this notion, well, is there a correlation to the number of ideas that you have and your success as an innovator? Turns out there is. Tremendous amount of research supports this notion. And all of a sudden, I had this concept. I went to a former professor of mine at Harvard Business School. I said, look, I have a semester left. What if I come back, we create an independent study, and I want to explore this idea more deeply? And that's exactly what we did. We created an independent study around this, and that became the first couple of chapters for my book. And that was really how that thing happened. I knew intuitively that the world seemed to work this way, but I then spent 3 years researching the academics behind it, research behind it, to sort of see what it is that we could, beyond the intuition, what is the research that supports this notion? And it's a tremendous amount of research that does that. And then I sort of interviewed people all over the world that operate at the intersection, and that became the book.
And I love that it was this the thought experiment that prompted this journey for you too. It reminded me of Einstein's light beam writing thought experiment. When he was 16 years old, he pictured himself writing next to a light beam, and then that eventually gave rise many, many years later to the special theory of relativity. So it's amazing that your journey also started with this vision of two light beams intersecting. The other intersection, of course, is that Einstein is one of the champions of this idea too, because in his own life he intersected so many different fields. He was a violin player. He had his own club where he and his friends met in Bern, Switzerland, discussing subjects like philosophy and political science. And so many of his ideas were inspired from that, from the cross-pollination of those different disciplines. The audience members might be familiar with the Medici family, but perhaps you can talk about that as well and why you decided to call the concept the Medici effect.
So at its core, right, when I decided to explore these intersections between cultures and fields and industries and so on, the core of that, as I said earlier, is that diversity drives innovation. Well, now I need to come up with a title for the book. It just took a lot of work to do that, but there was an analogy that I kept on coming back to, and that was what happened in Florence, Italy, about 500 years ago. And at that time, the Medici family was basically the most powerful family in Europe. They frequently went up and sort of butted head with the Pope and other regions. They did something interesting. They sponsored highly creative individuals from lots of separate disciplines: architects, sculptors, philosophers, painters, Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, from all of Europe. In fact, even as far away as from China. And they sort of brought them and attracted them to the city of Florence. And here these people were able to break down the boundaries between disciplines, between the different cultures, and ignite what we today know as the Renaissance. And so this book is really about that effect that the Medici family created and how we can create the same effect ourselves. That was the title of the book, and that's ended up becoming its own concept. I mean, people talk about this effect now all over the world. It's just had a viral quality to it that has helped people understand how to break new ground.
You have so many wonderful examples in the book of how the Medici effect works. Could you give the audience an example that might jump to mind about how the effect works and how it drives innovation?
Once you start thinking this way, you start seeing it all over the place.
Right.
I opened the book with one of my favorite examples, which is an architect who's been asked to design a building in Harare, one of the largest buildings in Harare, but without using any air conditioning in it, which is, you know, intriguing because it occasionally gets hot in Harare. That's in Zimbabwe. But he manages to accomplish this by combining his field of expertise, which was architecture, with the field of termitology. And see, termites build these mounds on the African savannah. You can just Google it and see these pictures. These sort of the mounds or columns that rise up from the ground, and they're able to keep an exact 87 degrees Fahrenheit inside of these mounds, and do that by creating these vents around the mound and redirecting air into a cool pool of mud at the bottom of the mountain, and then they open and close so that these vents constantly to regulate the temperature. So he looked at us and said, well, I can use this sort of design principle for my building, which is what he did, saved them $4 million right away, uses no AC sort of system, and with a steady temperature of about 71 degrees Fahrenheit. And so here you see, he didn't come up with a solution because it was just an expert in architecture or an expert in thermal ecology. It's because he combined these concepts. And you can see this over and over and over again, right? If you have the ability of bringing together two concepts, then you're actually innovating. But the key is that all new ideas, by the way, are combinations of existing ideas. But what's really powerful is that if the ideas that you combine are disparate, if they seem far apart, if they're not obvious, then you're enhancing the possibility of the solution of this new idea being innovative. And this is actually at the heart of why diverse and inclusive teams are innovative. It's about bringing together their different perspectives.
Let's talk a little bit about how you, since you mentioned diversity and inclusion, I think they refer to different concepts, right? And so let's talk about how you define those terms, diversity on the one hand and inclusion on the other hand. And I ask that because I think those words, particularly diversity, has become somewhat of a buzzword that gets thrown around a lot. So that's, I think, even more important to define what it actually means and what you're referring to when you say diversity and inclusion.
So they are very different things. Diversity at the Medici Group, which is the company that I started around the ideas of the Medici effect. Here we define diversity along sort of four dimensions. The first one is who you are. That has to do with your background. That's your age, your race, your gender, your sexual orientation, et cetera. It has to do with what you do. That's the second dimension. That is your education, your function inside of a company, the industry you're in, and so on. The third one has to do with how you do it. Are you extroverted? Are you introverted? And then lastly, with whom you do it. These are the networks that you built, either inside of an organization or in your community or in the broader world. But those are the four dimensions that along which we define diversity: who you are, what you do, how you do it, and with whom you do it. Inclusion is something very different. Inclusion refers to how able are you to bring all these different perspectives to bear in a useful way. We often talk actually about inclusion being a way of activating diversity, right? Now the fact is that you can actually have a lot of inclusive, there's a lot of conversations about inclusion today, and there are a lot of teams that are inclusive. It's just they're not diverse. It's right. Easy to be inclusive when you're not diverse. So you can see how these concepts are actually not the same. So the key is to have diverse teams and be able to be inclusive of that diversity. And that has to do with how are you able to bring in perspectives that are different from yours? How able are you to then make use of those perspectives? How able are you to act upon those? Not just the perspectives themselves. The networks has to do with action. Are you able to test, learn, execute, experiment, scale up? We find that diversity and inclusion is key to every single aspect of an innovation cycle or process. No matter how you look at it, coming up with the idea, selecting the idea, executing it, all of these cases, D&I drives your success rate as a team or as an individual.
I love the way you define those two terms, and it is really important to highlight, as you did, that you can have diversity without inclusion, and you can have inclusion without diversity as well. So both are really important. How does your firm, the Medici Group, take these concepts and then turn them into actionable ideas to share with clients? Is there a particular example that jumps to mind that highlights how applying these principles can transform a company?
So the way we think about it is that we help companies become faster, you know, more adaptive, more innovative, agile, collaborative. And we do it with the explicit intent of driving business outcomes. So the entire focus is how do we accelerate business outcomes? How do we increase growth rates? Growth is huge, as I'm sure you know, many of the people that you have interviewed come back to. Efficiencies also. In all these cases, what's really happening today is that the way business gets done is changing. Let me just take a second to sort of highlight how the conversation I've had with CEOs around the world have changed. You know, 10 years ago, the topic of that conversation might have been, what's my next killer product? And then that changed. So 5 years ago, it became, what's my next killer business model? But now that's not the question I'm getting from CEOs. The question I get from CEOs today is the world outside of my organization changing faster than inside it? Which is a very different question. It relates to the speed of change, the rate of change, and whether or not organizations are able to keep up with that. So that's this problem that we set out to solve. And we believe that that problem is solved in teams. We believe that the future is team-oriented. Increasingly, you're going to see an incredible, you've seen an incredible rise of teams. It's only going to keep on going. And that the most and the highest performing teams are basically diverse and inclusive. So what we do is we work with teams on a team-by-team basis and coach these teams towards driving higher business outcomes by using diversity and inclusion as sort of a core driver of that change. And then at an enterprise level, at a senior leadership level, we then work with the CEOs and their leaders to understand how do you, as your team increases its ability to be faster, more collaborative, et cetera, how are you able to then embed this at an enterprise level? Now, we've had the great fortune of working with some of the world's most terrific brands and companies, whether that is, you know, a Disney or a Nike, whether it's Caterpillar, whether it's Pfizer. So virtually every industry, organizations are facing these challenges. But sometimes we have the opportunity to see how these play out outside of these sort of organizational walls. We worked with Disney for over 11 years at this point. And I think you can see there's a reason why that company, I believe, is way ahead of the game when it comes to understanding how to innovate its products, its movies, its TV shows, its experiences in the parks with incorporating the idea of diversity and inclusion at all kinds of different levels throughout. I mean, if you just look at their movies and TV shows and products and experiences, you will see that this is something that is coursing all the way through. And I think that has been in part a result of all this work.
When companies do implement these principles and they focus not only on creating diverse teams, but also, as you said, activating diversity through inclusion, are there any... And I'm asking this because I've heard a corporate executive say this before at a meeting, or he was concerned that activating these interpersonal differences can create friction within the team itself and undermine the unity of the team and the unity of the message. How do you answer that objection? I don't know if it comes up in your work.
It does come up in the work. That gets to the inclusion piece, right? Mm. So here's an interesting piece around it. I think a diverse team that is not functioning is probably is likely to underperform a homogeneous team that is functioning. So it does require you to think about the inclusion piece, because you can just imagine this. One can sort of see how this plays out. We can see this ourselves. You know, imagine you have a team, you bring together people, and there's some differences in that, and then you're not trying to incorporate those differences. I mean, people are going to ask themselves, well, why are we even here? What is the whole point of this? And then that sort of creates that type of a challenge. Now, on the other hand, it is also true that it's okay if not everybody agrees on everything. In fact, that is kind of the point. So what is it that you're actually looking for? What is it that you're striving towards as a team leader? And what you really want, right, is that you want better recombination of ideas from these teams. But what you don't want is to find a mediocre middle. And that is where some people misunderstand the power of this diversity. It is this idea that sometimes it's easier to not work to bring in everybody's perspective. And either what we do is let's just simply take an average of what people are thinking. Let's compromise left and right, rather than sort of looking at, are we developing better ideas? Are we coming up with better solutions, better approaches? I mean, more creative ones, more innovative ones. That's really the aim that we should be going for in teams. So that's my first point. My second point is this. I don't know of an organization where teams are consistently becoming less diverse. They're becoming more diverse. I mean, it may happen way too slowly, but they're still becoming more diverse. So the question for somebody who sort of says, look, I'm worried about the friction. Well, if let's say you don't even buy into innovation, you're like, well, maybe, maybe not. Well, you, what you're going to be faced with, though, is increased diversity. And if a broad definition of that, that could include, for instance, bringing together two different corporate cultures. M&A activity is at a sky high rate. You're going to find yourself having to do that. How are you thinking about that? How are you thinking? Is it easier to ignore the friction or to actually lean in on it and make use of it? That's basically the heart of the idea of using D&I to drive innovation.
Yeah, I love that. So friction is going to be there. You can ignore it, you can suppress it, or you can actually activate it and make use of it to create more innovative products. And I also like what you said before, too, with respect to your first point, which is that, you know, homogenous teams perhaps might be more efficient, but they're going to be more efficient at creating mediocre products that are not going to do great for the company.
And this is a huge point, because what is actually happening, broadly speaking today, is that the need for innovation is going up, not down. And that means the need for any given team to increasingly outperform is also going up. And we're seeing that. We're seeing companies that have to make increasingly more innovative, more groundbreaking, more perhaps perceived as riskier bets, right? Otherwise, they will be out-competed. They will be ultimately become made irrelevant. So in other words, what a diverse team is good at, which is to create more exceptional ideas and solutions, is becoming increasingly important.
I'd love to switch gears a little bit now, friends, and talk about your failures. When you look back on your life, what's one of the most valuable failures you've had, and what makes it valuable?
It's a great question. This is one of the reasons why I really love the focus of your podcasts. Failures are all around. I'm sure many of the people you have out on will agree to this. And they've been just lots of them throughout my life. But of course, once you grasp the value of those failures, I have a hard time viewing them as such. By equal measure, I have actually a hard time identifying success either. These two things kind of go hand in hand, in my opinion. It's so with that in mind, when I think about things that went in a way that I perhaps didn't expect them or decide them to go when I started on the project, almost all of them have added to where I am today. And those that may have the biggest impact will have probably come earlier in life. When I was in high school, avid Dungeons and Dragons player, or I should say the Swedish version of that, which is called Dragons and Demons by translation. So play Dungeons and Dragons all the time. Actually, I kind of still do. So now the thing was that that at the time I got an idea for a major book within this space. Let's call it a mix between a fiction book and what one could sort of call a campaign module, a game design book. I was in 10th grade when I thought of it. I basically contacted the major publisher in Sweden on this and asked them, you know, were they open for me writing this? And they said yes. So I spent 18 months writing this book, and then they bought it. And I was exceptionally excited beyond. Like, this was one of the, and I kept on telling, I mean, I told everybody about it, of course. And then something happened. It prolonged. It didn't actually get released when I thought it was going to get released. There was something going on. Then I started at college. I was telling everybody about it. And then I find out that the publisher basically went into bankruptcy. That book was not coming out. It was a moment because, first of all, I told everybody about it. Didn't even believe that I'd written it. I came to realize that a tremendous amount of self-worth had been placed not just in the act of writing the book, but in it actually being published. Like, I would have been happy to give back every single cent that they paid me for that manuscript, which wasn't a lot. But anyway, if it had been published, what I took away from that, what it enabled me. So once I went through that process, right, and I finally got through, let's call it this moment of period of grief, perhaps, or disappointment, I landed at a completely different place when I came out of it, which was that, oh, my God, okay, fine. It's what happened. But I did write it. I know I wrote it. I kept on then seeing lessons transferable into virtually everything else I did. You know, there was a 500-page manuscript I put together. So now tackling my thesis, no problem. That's just a piece of cake. And this kept on building and building and building until, in fact, when I got the idea to write the Medici Effect, and this is why it was so transformative for me, the one question everybody kept on asking me was, you have no idea what it means to write a book. Like, this is all the naysaying things. It wasn't about the theory. It was just, you have no idea what it means to write a book. It is impossible. And I was able to say, well, actually, I have. All of a sudden, that experience, that journey of the failure of that moment, of that book not being published and not being able to have something to talk about, that was when I finally got to write the Medici Effect. That was when this all thing clarified. And since then, I don't know if I've felt like I've really encountered any failures. Everything is something that can be reframed into a success. I just have to be very active in finding what that is.
And I love that you mentioned the reframing too, because, you know, somebody else in your shoes could have looked at that as a complete waste of time, right? They could have said, well, I spent all this time, I spent all this energy, all this enthusiasm into writing a book, and they didn't even publish it. I'm not even going to try writing a book again. But you reframed that as an investment. Even if it never saw the light of day, the work that you put into writing that book, into structuring it, as you said, has been invaluable to writing your thesis and then writing the Medici Effect later on down the road.
That's right. And the power of that reframe. And I know this is something people talk about with some frequency, but I don't think enough. We can choose. We can actively choose how we feel or experience something. This is a choice. It may not feel like that perhaps at the moment, but the more you believe that that is possible, that you can actually do that. I had started sensing that early on in life, but this was the piece that really put together all the keystone pieces, sort of kept up this whole arc of understanding of how one can progress and move forward.
One of the other experiences you mentioned earlier that I wanted to come back to, if you're okay talking about it, is that you said you had started a number of businesses with your cousin, and the software company that you started, you ultimately ended up winding it down. Can you tell us about that experience and how that influenced you?
So the first company I started was Bootstrap, right? We started in a garage. We got $10,000 from family to go ahead and do it. And it was healthcare based in Baltimore. The second one was very different. It was a venture running 1,000 miles an hour. This one caught the imagination of, I think, of a lot of press at the time. There were several magazine covers, front page stories, et cetera, et cetera. And we were hiring like crazy. In fact, for about a semester at Harvard Business School, I left for a semester to go because we started it in the fall of the second year. And so I was sitting in class, you know, with the number of employees just growing week by week. This was one of those things where it was just growing very quickly. And it turned out right to not work. And finally, we were fortunate enough to catch it on reasonably. We started unwinding it. Obviously, it still sucked. All our investors got hurt. And ultimately, both of us went back to our first company that we still had and licked our wounds, went back down to Baltimore. So that was basically a year of us just trying to explore a few different ideas. That's when I thought of that's really when the Medici Effect landed truly as a concept. And I reached out to go back to Harvard Business School to complete the final semester. But here's the interesting learning of this. I realized that I had mistaken everybody else's perception of our success with actual success. Look, how can we fail? I mean, look at this newspaper story. Look at this article. Look at what everybody's saying. Look at how everybody's joining us. We had venture capitalists dying to get into our first race. They were like leaving voicemail. Like everything was telling us that this is a huge success. And what it taught me is that none of that is actually real. And it's made me exceptionally well prepared for understanding the difference between hype, which can be useful in certain marketing circumstances. Okay, sure. But nothing beats actual, real, genuine success as you are driving towards something. And that has informed me ever since. I haven't really been chasing any of the particular press. If it comes, that's great. But it is about the underlying success. It's about what it is that you do that's going to matter. And then, hey, if that is a great story to tell, and that's great. But that was the real insight I got from that. And this is also when I started questioning not just what failure is, but what is actually success itself. I don't think it's that straightforward to define. It's kind of like a second derivative. It constantly changes. And so maybe that's not where you should be looking.
Well, I think that's the perfect note to wrap up this conversation on, Franz. Thank you so much for joining us, for sharing your ideas, your failures, and your strategies for reframing and looking both at failure and success as well. And I completely agree with you. They are a lot closer to each other than we assume. And we really benefit ourselves and companies too from following the same processes and same procedures, following both a perceived failure and a perceived success. If people are interested in finding out more about you and what you're doing in the Medici Group, where can they go?
There's some social connections. You can find me easily on LinkedIn. We have a website, themedicigroup.com, themedicigroup.com, and a few other places as well, Twitter. That would be the easiest. Just connect and reach out.
We'll put all of that in the show notes as well. Franz, thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.